So it's my great pleasure today to introduce all of you to Susan Krieger, who is our honored guest. Susan, for those of you who don't know, is a sociologist. She's a communication scholar and writer, and she's currently a research fellow at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. She is the author of 7 previously published books. One is Come, Let Me Guide You, A Life Shared with a Guide Dog. The second, Traveling Blind, Adventures in Vision with a Guide Dog by My Side. Third, Things No Longer There, A Memoir of Losing Sight and Finding Vision. Fourth, The Family Silver, Essays on Relationships Among Women. Fifth, Social Science and the Self, Personal Essays on an Art Form. Then The Mirror Dance, Identity in a Women's Community, and last, Hip Capitalism. I first encountered Susan's work in the early to mid-1980s. Her book, The Mirror Dance, Identity in a Women's Community, is truly a classic. It was one of the first narrative ethnographies and was written with the women's voices speaking to each other. I then used her book on social science and the self, Personal Essays in an Art Form, published in 1991, in some of my earliest autoethnography classes. There, she made some of the first arguments for autoethnography, though she did not call it that at the time, and she made a strong case for writing in a literary way and writing personally from and about the self. Though I did not know Susan personally at that point, I carried her books around with me to remind me that Arden and I were not the only ones making these claims. We had company, and we learned a lot from Susan's work. When Susan published The Mirror Dance, I was working on Final Negotiations. The same year that Social Science and the Self came out, I published articles on introspection and emotional sociology, and Art and I were writing about narrative and writing personal stories, followed by composing ethnography in 1996. And so much else was happening at that point, just all over. And some of the people we knew who were doing this work and some of the people we didn't know who were doing this work, but it really felt around that time like it was a paradigm shift, at least for many of us. I had the opportunity then to connect with Susan this past year when Temple University Press asked me to review her new book. It is another tour de force about the self and intimate relationships with others in time and in space. And it will be coming out with Temple University in a few weeks, and you can see the cover is already prepared. And just for your information, the intro to the book is linked in the program if you want to read the intro to this book. So, Susan, would you like to tell us now a little bit about your impress book?
Yes.
Are You Two Sisters, The Journey of a Lesbian Couple?
Thank you very much, and thank you for that introduction. Yes, I've long felt you were a kindred spirit. So, I am Susan Krieger, and I wanted to say hello to everyone who is attending. I'd like to tell you a little about my new book, Are You Two Sisters? The Journey of a Lesbian Couple. So this is an autoethnography in which I draw on personal experience, but I do it through the creation of stories about a lesbian couple and their 40-year journey through life and to different parts of the country. I focus on issues of self and other, of the intimate relationship between the two women over time and how this changes and similarities and differences, because the two are women and that makes a big deal of difference in terms of the relating. And I focus on the self, other issues between the lesbian couple and the outside world. The book deals with issues of gender, obviously, sexuality, and disability, because in addition to being a lesbian, I am blind, and this affects my relationship with my partner and with the outer world, and in a way, how I see things. It causes me to value even more than before the inner personal voice, the internal processing of events that helps us navigate through the world. Now, I should explain first, to give you a sense of it, the title, Are You Two Sisters? As the book explains in the chapter by that title, Are You Two Sisters? That sentence comes from an experience that I had, and I think I will speak in the first person, I, we, but you should know the book in a way presents the couple as if they were a fictional couple. I draw from my experience, but you know, it's never totally accurate and it's designed to get at those issues of self and other. But I'll speak here in terms of I, even though the character in the book that is me is in my mind a character, not the exact I. But anyway, so the genesis for that chapter in the book title is that my partner, whom I call Hannah in the book, we were traveling in the New Mexico desert, very south in a remote area near the border of Arizona and Mexico. And we had just had lunch in a very isolated bar restaurant. I was going out to the car while Hannah was paying our bill. And a man came after me in the bar, followed me to the door, and he questioned me in a somewhat challenging way. He said, "Are you two sisters?" And I thought, uh-oh. I don't know. I don't want to answer him. What am I supposed to say? It's in a bar. He may be drunk. I headed out the door following my guide dog. And I think he could see that I was possibly blind because I was making my way around the tables erratically and I had a guide dog. I went out the door and I was going outside to the car parked in the adjacent parking lot. The man seemed to follow after me, and he called as I followed my dog to the car, and he said again, "Can I help you? Are you two sisters?" You know, real loud so I could hear, and I thought, what do I do now? I just wanted to make a beeline for the car, but I was flashing in my mind, well, what do I do? Turn around and say, "No, we're lesbians. What are you going to make of that?" You know, you just, it feels like a very private thing, and all of a sudden someone is assaultively, it feels, questioning, even though it's not a physical assault, it's an invasion of the privacy. And I thought, if I turn around and say I'm a lesbian, what's he going to do? Address, you know, undress us in his mind and see us in bed? That's always the vision I have. So my dog and I quickly made it to the car. I had him jump in and I slammed the door. Now, fortunately, the man went back inside the bar and that was that. But I was shaken. And my partner, Hannah, came out after paying our bill. We get in the car. We start driving off on our daily travels. And I tell her what happened. And she says, "Well, what did you say to him?" And I said, "I didn't say anything." And I felt ashamed. You know, I felt like, well, it's 2017. There's more acceptance of lesbian. What was he going to do? Probably nothing much. But I couldn't bring myself to say it. And that question haunted me during our travels. And as I wrote this book, I was already well two-thirds of the way probably through the autoethnography. And I thought of the importance of that encounter and how protective I and often many other women are as lesbians with relation to the outside world. We have to guard our boundaries. People often step over it. And it seemed an apt title for a book that deals with self-other and the importance of safeguarding a sense of individual integrity and individual sense of self, both in relation to the outer world, but also within the lesbian couple, that being two women, you know, we're often very other-oriented or deferential of the self to the other, and the line between self and other can get blurred. So also within the relationship, the need to protect and have a boundary between self and others so that the individual can feel a sense of integrity and inviolability is also important. So that's Are You Two Sisters? The book, the autoethnography, has many stories in which I follow and look at the relation between self and other with respect to the outside world and within the couple. There, okay. I think that's my summary.
Okay, thank you. So what we want to do next is read, since you haven't been able to see the book, since it's not quite out, I think it will be out in a few weeks,
yes,
right?
Yes.
But we thought we would read just a very short segment. It's about 4 minutes. And Susan and I agreed that I would do the reading since it's difficult for her with her limited vision to read from a text. So I'm sure I can't do it the way you would do it, but I will do my best.
Thank you.
And this is called our marriage day. I had rolled over in bed earlier that morning and given Hannah a kiss, as I do every morning before getting up. But this day was going to be different. "Happy marriage day," Hannah said from out of her sleep, returning my kiss softly, lingering with it more than usual. "Happy marriage day," I said, feeling an awkwardness about how the day would go, the high expectations, fearing what might be different after the big event. What would it do to us? I wondered. We had been okay as a couple so far. We had come a long way. We'd learned how to get on lovingly with each other, sometimes with pain and effort, but we were doing all right. Now, after 32 years together, we were going to change things. Why mess with it? I thought. I had visions of couples who build a new house so they can live happily ever after. And then when it is done, they break up. I did not want that to happen to Hannah and me. "Do you think we'll be okay?" I asked my love as she lay beside me in the warm bed. "Of course, don't worry. It's just City Hall. I'm going back to sleep," she said. Leaving her comfortably under the covers and stepping out of the room to get dressed, I thought about the first time I had been married, back when I was in graduate school in the 1970s. The man I married later would choose to be gay, and I would choose lesbianism, but we did not know that then. At the time, I think we did what was conventionally expected of us, fulfilling dreams for how we ought to be, and the next step we should each take in life. I did not, even then, believe in the necessity of marriage. It seemed to me too full of expectations about how two people ought to behave together. And it seemed to confer a higher status than that which would befall me as an individual unmarried woman. But only after we got married did the momentousness of it hit me. I looked down at my gold wedding band and suddenly thought, this should not be. I should not be getting extra privileges because I am now married. People should not be looking at me differently as a more desirable woman, perhaps, because I'm married to a man, because someone wants me. But most of all, it was the extra rights and privileges that bothered me, the legal and financial advantages, the sense that it was viewed as better to be a couple than alone. I thought that all the same advantages should be given to persons as individuals. The couple should not be the more valued unit. Thus, as I looked at the ring on my finger, although I liked it, a classic thin gold band like my mother had, I did not like what it stood for, even as I wore it proudly, basking in the social acceptance it offered. Joel and I were married in my parents' backyard. I wore a white dress with a short skirt and a lacy top with a high neck and purple shoes. Joel wore a boldly colored flowered tie and a pinstriped blue suit. After we had said our vows beneath a huppah under tall trees, standing across from the rabbi, Joel smashed the traditional glass and the family and friends made sounds of approval, calling out Mazel Tov and clapping for us as we walked back toward the house while a string quartet played. We had stepped out of earshot when Joel turned to me. "We can break up at any time," he said. "This doesn't have to be forever." I felt relieved. Those were my sentiments exactly, knowing what often happened with couples. I then went back to mingling with the guests. It was going to be quite different now, I thought. No white dress or flowered tie, no man, no audience, no reception in the yard. Thank goodness. But it still was a ceremony, a charade in some sense of that word, a performance that might have little relationship to my inner reality. Hannah and I would have to go to City Hall. We would have to sign papers. I was not looking forward to that, though I was looking forward to going to the beach afterwards with our dogs. I deeply loved Hannah, and I wanted to keep being with her, but there was something about the romanticization surrounding marriage, the sentimentality, the sense of forever, as if a statement of vows could make that happen. There was something about the unconventionality of everything Hannah and I had experienced together. Not only were we lesbians, but I was me, not quite fitting in, not like everyone else, uncomfortable often in my own skin. Would marriage make me more comfortable, more secure? Would it make us happier? I wondered. Lovely, lovely beginning chapter.
Well, the book. Thank you. Thank you for that reading.
You're welcome. It was fun to do. So I told Susan that I thought that people here at this conference would be very interested in her writing and how she goes about writing the text, because she does a lot of scene setting, character development, dialogue, and so on. And so I thought I would just ask a general question of what your experience of writing the book was like, and maybe that will lead us into more specific questions about your writing.
Sure. Thank you very much. That's a fascinating topic. I think that for me, the essential thing in writing is the relationship with the reader. I don't write for myself or for the printed page in isolation. I am always talking to a reader and trying to take the reader with me. I do set a scene. I try to visually describe it and emotionally describe a scene so the reader can be right there with me. And in this book, Are You Two Sisters?, I would often set the scene and then put the couple in the scene and then have their dialogue and work that out. So number one is the relationship with the reader. The second is, that goes through all my work, but specifically with this book, is I want the reader to keep reading. So I try to make my stories have a certain sense of drama. I try to make my prose have a flow. I don't know, this is an odd thing and may not work at all together, but I try to end every paragraph on a kind of lilt that makes you have to go to the start of the next paragraph. Now, that may not keep the reader reading, but to me, it keeps the flow going. So it's number one, relation with the reader. Number two, keep the reader reading. Number three, what I try to do in this book, as elsewhere in this book, I'm focusing on the relationship between self and other, and on intricacies that I can draw from my experience and paint into that picture that illustrates something that seems to me important about, let's say, within the couple, the differences and the similarities between the two women and how they try to articulate who they are in relation to each other as compared with merging one into the other. What are some of the dilemmas, conflicts, resolutions? So I keep a focus on that self-other relationship as I draw from my experience and write. So I think those would be maybe the four things. The reader, keep the reader reading. Write the stories in a way that sets the scene that brings the reader in, and focus continually on that external subject, even if I am drawing from my individual experiences within the couple and in relation to the outside.
Okay. Thank you. I found it fascinating that, your last sentence in each paragraph, you try to make it evocative enough that the person wants to read in the next paragraph.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work to do that.
Right.
But,
yes.
But certainly your writing does do that, because I couldn't put your manuscript down, and I couldn't wait to continue reading it. It was just fascinating, and I was so drawn into your story. And I was drawn into how you set the scenes. And I really studied what you did, because I'm not sure that's one of my strengths. And it seems to be one of yours, that you are taking us on this journey. And we see the things, we feel the things that, you are feeling and experiencing. And so could you talk a little bit about how you do that?
The writing of the scene, I'm not sure, so much of what we do, what I do, it comes naturally, and so I'm not aware of the technicalities of it, but I think that it goes along with my relation with the reader, that when I do my first drafts, I'm really spewing forth a stream of consciousness that will follow an emotional flow and set it up, and I'll remind myself in my mind, well, the reader really needs to have an image of it. And maybe some of this is more recent because of my loss of eyesight. I'm particularly aware of painting a scene that someone can see in order to be in it. So I will imagine that scene. And in a way, you take for granted your own environment and sense of scene, but I have to constantly remind myself, the reader doesn't know. The reader can't be right there. One thing that I don't do is I don't describe individual people and their faces or what they look like. And it doesn't intuitively come to me. And it didn't even when I had full eyesight. But setting the scene just seems to me important so they can inhabit the space. So I don't know there's any particular technique as much as my reminding myself to do it.
Okay. And I think that's that ethnographic part of you, which I think is so important in a good autoethnography. You know, you scan out and you think about not just what's going on with you or even just what's going on with you and the other person, but the whole scene that you're in and, you know, how do you connect
right.
what's happening to the scene?
Right. It's always with that external eye as well.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about memory? Like, you know, you're having to, I don't know when you write about something that happened, but you're, whenever it is, you're having to remember what happened and you're having to turn this memory into, you know, dialogue and so forth. And even if you don't want to talk about technique, just to talk about that experience of having to do that.
Sure. Yes. I think I have found that if I write about an experience too soon, too close to when it happened, it's going to be far too detailed. But in having some retrospective ability, it allows certain things to stand forth that are more important, so the experience is more usable. And I don't know, I feel that I follow my own stream of consciousness and see what comes forth and very selectively use what comes forth. It's only a small piece of the whole, but I'm not sure it would just come naturally to me. I think that certain items stand out and I feel, oh, this is a useful incident. Like that man saying, are you two sisters? I thought, oh, I can really use this. So it's not simply memory of what happened in the past, because I'm not writing memoirs. Here's a record of what happened in my past. You know, I'm, like you said, writing ethnography. And I'm constantly trying to draw pieces from my experience that are relevant to the larger theme or subject. So as soon as I find a little incident that I think, oh, this will be useful, then I just go back in time or go specifically to that incident in terms of my experience of it. Yes, that I remember, but that I see. And memory is so often faulty. You know, I try to get something accurate to exactly what happened, but I know that I'm terrible, you know, that there are going to be many errors. But I try to get the sense of it accurate. And when I make up dialogue, obviously I don't have a recording from the past, so I'm getting an inner sense of what that dialogue might have been. So I'm very aware of the invention, that it's not simply memory, it's selective drawing from experience and invention, but trying to remain faithful.
Right. And that just reminds me to ask you about, I mean, you've written so much about fiction and social science, to ask you, do you think of what you're doing as fiction or social science, or how do you think about it?
Yeah, I think of it as social science, you know, as ethnographic sociology, autoethnographic sociology, because it definitely is following that focus on one particular phenomenon, subject, theme, trying to elucidate it. Within that, it's fiction. It's not word for word, par for par, exactly what happened. It's a creation designed to draw from my individual experience in all in order to throw light on that broader subject or theme. So I would say it's fiction within.
Okay. And I think people would be interested in hearing perhaps how you go about writing, especially given your vision issues. You know, how did it actually take place? The writing of the text.
Yeah. Okay, I'll say something about that gladly. I don't know how totally accurate I'll be because, you know, it does change, but I preferred when I could write longhand and see my print and everything, and it was a pace that was better. This is before my vision loss. When I started to write at the computer, my fingers could go much quicker on the keys mm-hmm. than when I wrote longhand, and I have to do much more revising because I'll have several ways that I'm writing out of how to make a sentence, and write them all down, and in the end I have to select. So I think that the computer, writing at the computer, has made a big difference from writing longhand. And then with my vision loss, I have had for many years a computer that speaks aloud for me. So I can no longer see the print and read it aloud to myself. I see it in a fuzzy way, but the computer's reading it aloud to me, so I'm hearing it through my ears, and I'm getting a sense of the inner voice through the computer speaking. So I now type at the computer, and then it reads everything back to me. Mostly, I think about my writing is my first drafts, especially with the computer speeding everything up, are very rough and they get the main flow, but 95% of what I do is revising, is listening or reading over and over again what I've written and trying to make it accurate, flow, create the scene properly, do all those economies you do with words. So I would say going over and over everything is the main thing that I do. Once I get that stream out, yeah.
I'm just going with the flow here and not following our outline, but I'm interested in how you so early on started writing in these experimental ways. Can you, we know when hardly anybody else was doing it in right. social science, certainly not in sociology. And so could you speak to that a little bit?
Oh, thank you. Yes. I don't know exactly. I think I have always felt, why do something the same as everybody else? And I think that initially I did write in the third person and all, but at some point early on, I began to get lost in my ability to manipulate words and ideas in the abstract. And I just felt I wasn't there. So that's when I started doing the more subjective first person writing. It helped me feel grounded. And I also feel many academic writings are general and they conform to certain expectations about what is currently popular, what are currently popular ways of viewing something and believing in something. And those are very interesting. But I felt that my contribution, I've never been a great conformist. Let's say, I just didn't want to go along with the flow of everything. I wanted to sort of make a difference, do something a little differently. And I also thought that the specifics that I could write could be more telling in a more complex way than the general theoretical. But I think that is may just be a desire to not conform, but make a bit of a little difference.
Yeah, I share that, I think. When I think back, I mean, I wrote traditionally as long as I had to. And I thought I did okay with it, but I never felt like, you know, this was really a talent that I had that was going to make any difference in the world. Yeah. And when I kind of created a different kind of writing and expressing myself, it felt like, to go back to the keynote today, it felt like I'd come home, right. You know, and that I did have something to offer. And it was so much more satisfying and fun to do and exciting. And I guess I, like you, didn't really want to be like everybody else either.
And you have made, I must say, you have made a huge difference in following what seemed to you right for you. I cannot tell you how indebted I am to everything that you have created in autoethnography and encouraged students and all the writings. You have made a huge difference with trying to be a little different. I've only made a little difference, but you are wonderful and have made, and I am grateful.
Thank you so much. And, you know, as I said in the introduction, and I meant it, you know, you really were one of the people who led the way. And you know, you want it, it's really important when you're out here doing this to feel like, you know, you're not alone. I mean, even if you do want to be different from everybody right. else, you don't want to be alone. You want to have other people working with you. And, you know, fairly early, you know, I had art, which, you know, made such a difference to me. But we both just loved your work and got so much out of it. And felt companionship out in the world from you. So thank you again for that.
Good.
I'll go back to the writing just for a minute, because I'm fascinated by the way in your book you could move from past to present. Again, that's something that I sometimes have, I feel a little awkward about moving back and forth, but you seem to do it so seamlessly.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that?
Sure. I think, you know, everyone is different. Like, we each draw on our own experiences and our own sense of what comes naturally to us. So probably that moving back and forth is just what comes naturally to me when I start with my stream of consciousness or my way of putting two and two together that flows from an internal source. And I have to fix that up a lot. Often when I first write that stream, I'll think it's wonderful or I'll think it's terrible. And I only through the revisions does it become something that's really usable, that will work for a reader. But I think we each have our tendencies. You do wonderful things with your analysis of the details and putting it together and all that thought. So I think it's just differences in what we each naturally come by.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, I'm naturally pulled to dialogue.
Yes.
I just
love dialogue.
I can hear it as I'm writing it. And I love writing dialogue. And I love reading books that have dialogue. Sometimes when I'm looking at novels to read, I look through to see how much dialogue it there's it's there. And if there's a lot of dialogue, I buy it. If there's not, I don't.
Right. Right. I feel similarly. Dialogue is great fun. And I have not read that much about how people do dialogue, but I have in mind that there are certain things that I should do and shouldn't do with dialogue, which one thing is that the dialogue is has to be economic. That if you have dialogue in there, it should, you don't need a lot of extra words with it.
Yeah.
And so there are certain ways of handling dialogue that I think are fascinating, and it's great fun.
Yeah, and there's a, you know, you don't want to be accurate with dialogue. I don't want to reproduce my normal dialogues because they're pretty boring and repetitious. So
right.
How you pick and choose, you know, how to just in a minimalist way, you know, get these complex ideas across or these scenes across.
Right.
Yeah. So I really was with you in your book just the whole way, the whole journey. I felt I was, you know, right there with you. And something I like, and I'm not sure I'm using the right words for it, but I felt you taking me with you, but I felt you giving me lots of room to interpret, think about, bring in my own experiences, whether it was different or similar, and you kind of analyze my own relationships and the different tensions and conflicts and joys, you know, in my relationship as well. And part of what I really appreciated about you is I never felt you were telling me this is the way it is. You were just opening up this space where I was, as a reader, really, you know, almost having a conversation with you about relationships and self and other and taking trips and so on. And I felt you, while you were guiding me and you were leaving me all this space, and you also sometimes showed me your doubt and some of your questioning, you know, so you just didn't declare this is the way it is. It was really an open kind of text. And so I wondered, how do you think about the role of doubt and questioning in your own writing? Because to me, it's a very important part of doing autoethnography.
Yes.
That kind of introspection.
Yes, thank you. Well, I'm glad you felt those ways. I do feel that when I write in the detailed manner, that I am leaving it to the reader to come along with me to experience the experience. And then I present my maybe feelings about her interpretation, but I like to leave it open, like you say, so that the reader, my ideal reader, would make up their own mind as they go. They have my input. And ideally, I think anyone in doing this, in writing about your own experience, to the extent you can do it well and accurately in some way, will enable a reader to visualize their own experience at the same time, that's the way it works. It's not like when you present general terms, this autoethnographic approach, when done well, enables the other to see in that double fashion, enables the reader to see both your experience and their experience at the same time. And I'm very glad when that works. And the openness, I guess, I do when I write, often use my internal self-doubts or wondering whether I'm okay or everything's going to work out or whatever it is, or whether I even have the right idea about something. So a lot of those ambivalences and self-questioning run throughout. And for some people, that's good to read. For other people, they feel like, God, I don't like all this author's unsureness about herself and everything and worries. But I'd rather do that than be the protagonist that has everything all together. But it also allows me to articulate different dimensions of something and to offer an idea, like an idea about why in a lesbian couple, the two of us have difficulty sometimes because of the boundary between us and not wanting to be merged and the merging and all different things. So I feel that if I offer my ideas in a kind of perhaps way, perhaps this is so, this is something I thought about when this happened, I offer them a little bit tentatively from myself, that allows a reader to take that in and at the same time maybe come up with other thoughts on the reader's part. And so I deliberately do that, but it also comes naturally.
Okay. And I think it's safe to say that this is your most personal book of all.
I think that with each book, so I'm not sure. I think it may be, you know, I'll leave that for others to see. Each of them has some very personal parts, and so that may be so.
Okay. And I wonder how you feel now that you have written it and it's about to be out in the world. What are your feelings about having written the book?
On to the next one. It takes so long. Once you have a book submitted to a publisher before it finally comes out, you have to start the next one. So I'm on to the next one. But in terms of this book, I think I'm feeling hopeful. I'm thinking, oh, I hope it goes well. I hope people like it. I hope they take from it some of these things you've mentioned that you took from it, that you are an ideal reader. You're wonderful in your review of the book, and you're almost my ideal reader. So my feelings are, I hope that other readers may take from my work some part of what you've taken from it. So it's a big open hope.
Yes, I'm sure they will. And just, you know, very quickly, because I want to leave a few minutes for people to ask questions. Well, I have two more I really want to ask. I want to write them too, but I also want to ask them. Of ethics. So you're writing your partner. Well, of course, we're never just writing about ourselves. You're writing
right.
about your partner. And so I wonder about, you know, how did you figure out that she would be okay with it? And did it affect your relationship with your partner? And could you just talk about any of those issues that you would like?
Sure. Sure. That's a big question. I think that everyone in their autoethnographic writing has their own version of what seems ethical and right for them to do. And mine are strictly my own. I'd say on this general subject, maybe I'd like to say this to be, I think that the primary ethical thing to do in writing autoethnography is to stay true to your own beliefs and ideas about what you ought to say. And that's what I follow. Now, I think I'm also very sensitive to others and their feelings. And so I may take for granted the degree to which I am sensitive and try to respond to others to present them in as positive a light as possible. So in this book, I would say ethically, number one, stay true to what I want to say. Ethically, number two, I've had an intimate partner who plays an important role in the story in the book. And I have all along tried to be extremely careful of Hannah is the fictional name I give her in the book. I've tried to be extremely careful about how she will feel because I am telling a story that also involves an intimate other. So I've checked with her all along in reading the chapters and how she feels, and we've had an understanding that if there was something really terrible that I wrote that she wanted out or changed, she should let me know and I would do that, or I would provide a very good reason why I ought not to do that. I've been fortunate in that my partner has been appreciative of my desires in writing the stories. And so even though there have been times where she might be uncomfortable about a certain thing, she would never write a chapter about one thing or another. She has accepted my desire for representation. And I have tried to paint the portrait in such a way that she would feel good about much of it. And I think she has. She's told me at times, she said, "You've made me Saint Hannah. You've been a little too good." So that was a compliment. Or I've written something that I'll think is fictional, and she'll say, "That's exactly the way it happened." And I'll say, "It's not exactly the way it happened. My memory is faulty, you know, and it's a bit of a construction." But I think we've had a back and forth process in which we've worked that out. But definitely, it's my book, and I'm responsible for it and the autoethnography. That first commitment is to how you want to see it and present it that comes internally from you. That's a very strong feeling on my part, and it may make me underestimate the degree to which I actually am sensitive to the other. I try to be careful of other persons and present them in a positive and understanding light, which I try to do in this book with respect to my intimate other, but also with respect to anyone else who crosses the pages. And that I feel that an autoethnography can present in such a positive light and understanding light that others can be accepting, even if it's not the way they might tell the story.
Good, thank you. And one last question, and then I'll see if we have a few comments from participants. You and I talked about this a little bit, that there might be generational differences in how lesbians experience or cope with or are in the world. And so I was wondering if you think, if that's true, if younger lesbians will relate to your experience.
Yes, generational differences do exist. I think each generation of lesbians, as far as we know, may often react to the previous generation. Like before me, there was more butch femme role playing, and then the next generation of which I was a part maybe favored more androgyny, and then there are newer generations now that have more gender fluidity in mind. There are many changes over time in how lesbians view themselves and interpret themselves and name themselves. So there are these changes. In my view of what happens over time, or what has happened with lesbianism, is that one persistent theme is the invisibility of lesbian experience. For instance, there are many lesbians out there. We know very little about most of them. We only know what's spoken by the most vocal and what's more commonly in the air. And because lesbians are women, and often have socially habits of deference to the other and taking care of the other and merging with their surroundings and keeping a low profile, there is this theme of the invisibility of lesbian experience that runs throughout the generations, no matter what people call themselves or different ideas about who we are and how our experience is to be interpreted. There's a certain amount of invisibility, and there's a certain amount of need to protect lesbian intimacy from insinuation, assault, invasion by the outside world, to keep this private, which increases the invisibility. So I think that Are You Two Sisters, The Journey of a Lesbian Couple, has a very central theme about the invisibility of lesbian experience, how hard it is to see it and to put a finger on it, because it's often subtle and hidden, and that this is a common theme, even over the generations, and that this is something to be learned from this book, to look closely and try to say, what's different here? What's hidden? Seeing the invisibility and how it plays out. So despite the differences, I think there are some persistent themes to do with that.
Okay, thank you. And this has been a wonderful conversation, and I hope that you and I can continue having conversations on Zoom or on the telephone, and hopefully can be in each other's presence.
Sometimes. Yes.
That would be wonderful.
Yes.
So we have a few questions in chat. Somebody asked, and this is a wonderful question, how do you know when an idea is a book?
You keep writing. If you keep writing on it, it interests you, then you just keep at it and it eventually gets longer.
How do you know to start writing about something?
Sit down at the computer and start writing.
Yeah. Well, I do that a lot. I sit and write, and sometimes it keeps going, and sometimes it doesn't.
Yes, or it'll evolve into a broader topic. And often I find when I'm working on a study that I don't know what the main theme is. I don't know what the subject I'm focusing on is. I have to continue at greater length to find out. And then often it's selection among many possibilities. So producing a wealth of writing or research and then looking at it and saying, what is this telling me? What are some of the central themes here? Oh, look, this is what I'm writing about. That's more the process.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but often, you know, I start to write because something grabs me and holds on to me and won't let go. And it's usually some kind of emotional experience that, you know, I really want to understand more myself. And I assume if I have this feeling, that other people have this feeling as well. And so, you know, I do use it partly as to understand my own experience, but partly because I think, well, this is really incredibly interesting that I can't let go of this. So right. Let me investigate it. It might be useful to somebody else as well.
Yes.
So somebody asked, do you have a follow-up book in mind? And you said you did. Do you want to tell us the topic or not?
I don't know the topic yet.
Okay, I've got about, that follows with what you were saying.
I've got about half of it. Yeah, I've got about half of it in draft form of one form or another, but this is one where the topic is going to reveal itself.
Okay, good. I love that. And then someone asked, how would you ethically handle those in our work who are no longer with us or estranged, yet central to our narrative?
Yes. I there again, this question of ethics, I wouldn't know. I think people vary, may have different views, even though a person may be a stranger, no longer with one, you may still have certain views about how properly to treat that person. And how I would handle it, I have had to deal with that type of situation. And I think each person just should go with their intuition.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've written some about this in various places. So if the people asking this question want to write to me, I can give you a resource. But, you know, it's very difficult to do because you think, well, you know, I've heard people say, well, you know, the person's dead. Now I feel like I can write about them. No,
still,
not necessarily, because they have other relationships in the world that you have to deal with. You have relationships with other people who have relationships with that person. You know, there's a sense of identity and legacy and what that person, how that person would want to be perceived and so on. So, you know, all of that has to be considered. It doesn't mean you can't write. It just means that all of that has to be taken into consideration.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Somebody just pre-ordered your book already. So you have one sale.
Good.
So anybody else, anybody want to ask a question? Stacy, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for reading, presenting, and discussing. I will also pre-order the book, as Andy has done. And I'm struck by the title of the book, Are You Two Sisters?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a testament to a cultural endemic that we are able and so willing to ask about personal relationships. I'm wondering, in the book, did you go into this a little bit about our culture around asking that question in the first place? Being asked is very shocking, and there's that beautiful wondering that you had around that when it was happening, and writing it in the book, and then Carolyn reading it. So I could feel the effect of that question. But did you turn it around at all in the book to, and this is the ethnographer in me wondering what the heck is going on in our culture, that that question is asked, that it's okay, or maybe not okay, but they do it anyway.
Right.
So any writing or exploring around that question, which is your book title as well?
Yeah, well, thank you. Yes, it is interesting. I think I do some of it, but not in any heavy-handed way. I know I have a reference to the fact that, you know, being blind, I travel with a guide dog. And over the years, people have often asked me on the street, are you training that dog? You know, and here I am walking with a harness that has a handle that says guide dogs for the blind. But they asked me, are you training that dog? And I felt it's a similar question. I refer to this in the book as when they asked me, are you two sisters? They're not coming out and saying, are you lesbians or are you blind? They're asking something that's a way that avoids the subject, that makes it nicety in terms of what's more common, not the more unusual. So it hides the deeper question. And I guess people, I don't know why, but people do ask. I think there's something deeper there that stirs them, that makes them feel a need to ask. So it reveals, I would say in the culture, it reveals a hidden maybe unease or questioning, or, you know, if they see and they wonder if I'm blind, they don't know what to do with it. So they ask, are you training that dog? They see the two women together. They look like they might be lesbians. So they ask, are you two sisters? It reveals, in a way, it's kind of nice. I mean, they're making personal contact. It's just a little difficult, but it indicates that underneath there's some source of emotional trigger or unease that is being articulated. So I think your question is good, and I don't generalize about it in the book, but I raise some questions.
Chris, pull us. You want to comment?
Yeah, just a comment. I am grateful there are other people around the world that just let the writing flow. That's kind of that's how I approach the process rather than planning it all out. But I fear that our academic culture sort of sets you up to try to figure it all out in advance, you know. So once my department chair asked me what my 5-year goals were, and I said, right, that's my 5-year goal, right, a lot maybe. But so, you know, I'm glad that not everybody has it backwards, and maybe it's just we nonconformist autoethnographers that are letting it flow. But I wanted to just say to everyone, don't try to figure it out in advance. It'll figure you out. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, I think that people vary. I know some people write wonderfully, do research wonderfully, and they plan it all in advance. They know what they're going to say before they do it. And there are other people like us who would rather be on that adventure of having it unfold.
Okay. A couple other comments here. Joan Eldridge asks, and I think this is an interesting question, in your book, do you speculate how things would have been different if a woman had asked this question?
That's an interesting question. On a recent trip to New Mexico in the Albuquerque airport just a couple weeks ago, we were getting our luggage out and I was waiting, and a woman asked me the same question as soon as I said, are you two sisters? So, and it wasn't quite the same in that a man in a bar who may have been drinking might have had a little bit of a different effect, but I thought, what is it about New Mexico or the Albuquerque airport that this happens to me? But it does happen elsewhere. It happens in our home. Somebody comes to repair the furnace and asks, are you two sisters? But when the woman asked, I thought, oh, do I disappoint her and tell her we're not two sisters? Lesbians, do I insult her? So maybe I was a little softer in my feelings in relation to the woman. And I did answer, it was in close proximity, a different circumstance. And I said, no, we're a couple. But I was with a little pause, like, do you just let it stand there and sit there and they'll think you're sisters for whatever reason? So I think I was a little less defensive.
Okay, and one other comment. You mentioned that your computer reads dialogue back to you. In that experience, are you focused on editing dialogue, or can you be the reader and enjoy your writing? Can you explain your process a bit?
Okay, yeah, the computer reads everything back to me. Everything that I type, it says every letter. And when there are keystrokes you use, it'll play it back. It'll read the whole page, everything, the dialogue, the whole text, everything. So do I enjoy the computer when it reads my prose back to me? Once I've revised it enough, I enjoy it. Short of revising it, I'll hear little things and I'll hear a comment in the dialogue. I say, a comment shouldn't be there. I should reword it. So yes, when I get closer to the final draft, I can enjoy it. I can laugh. A lot of the things I write in these stories have humor in them, and I can totally enjoy it.
Okay. Thank you very much. I mean, we could go on and on. This has just been wonderful. I've so enjoyed it, and I think everybody else did too. And thank you so much, Susan, for joining us. And we hope you will be at all our conferences from now on. We would love to have you.
Thank you.